those outside of our faith. And so, you know, some specific items that might be of interest there. So, first of all, then, defining what do I mean by conversational apologetics? There we go. To start with apologetics, the definition of apologetics is, first, is offering expressing an apology or an excuse. And my mother-in-law, sometimes when we've talked about, you know, engaging in apologetics, she's like, well, we shouldn't apologize for the gospel. Well, yeah, that is one definition sort of relating to apology. But another definition is, self-deprecating or humble, as in an apologetic manner, which is maybe useful in this context, but it's not quite what we're talking about. The third, though, is, of course, what we really mean, and we usually say apologetics, and that is the formal argumentation in defense of something, such as a position, defending a position, or defending a system of belief. And then the fourth is a branch of theology that is concerned with defending or proving the truth of the Christian doctrine, or in our case, the Restoration doctrine specifically. So that's really what we're talking about with apologetics. So next with conversation. There we go. Obviously, we know that conversation is a spoken exchange of thoughts, opinions, feelings, or just general conversation or talk. There's another definition, though, and this comes from the Bible Dictionary. It says, the goings out and in of social intercourse, one's deportment in the course of life. And in the Bible, it is never used in the sense of verbal communication. That word conversation actually means behavior. And I believe, if I remember correctly, there were a few places in the Inspired Version where Joseph actually changed the word conversation to something that actually meant something more like behavior. And that is actually the real meaning of it in the Bible. And it's also used, in a sense, in a few verses, meaning citizenship. And so that's going to tie in with some of the things that I'm going to be talking about, is that our conversational apologetics is more than just verbalizing our beliefs, but it's an interaction. It's a way of life. And I guess I was just continuing on. I already said it. Joseph Smith changed some of these references to conversation to read conduct, which is actually more correct and more the actual definition of the word in the Bible context. So, conversational apologetics is defending and proving our beliefs through verbal communication and through good conduct. And just a few verses, let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers in word and in behavior, conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, and in purity. And so this class is specifically not necessarily dealing with how to quote-unquote witness to others, although really it touches on a lot of these things, but it's also going to touch on issues of living our witness as well as defending our beliefs. And sometimes a little slow sometimes. So conversational apologetics doesn't start with verbal communication or with apologetics, but it begins with you and me, our behavior, our manner of life, and how we conduct ourselves in our relationships to others, our convictions, and our testimony. As the saying goes, they need to know that we're a Christian before we even say a word. And I had a few examples of that. One friend of mine in college, I went to Southwest Baptist University for 2 years and made some really good friends, and I was able to share, you know, in Bible studies and different things with our beliefs. And there was this one friend of mine who I'd been friends with him for about 3 semesters, and I was about ready to leave and go to the next university. And I realized, you know, we've had just excellent dialogue and just very much eye to eye on a lot of different, Christian beliefs and deep theological discussions. But I don't know that I've ever shared with him my specific restoration beliefs. And I got kind of convicted about that I needed to be more than just a good Christian with him. I needed to share something beyond what he had to, those things, the fullness of the gospel that we believe. And so under that conviction, I decided, okay, I better, make a chance here before I leave, to at least share with him a little bit. So we sat down at lunch one day, and I asked him what he thought about the Book of Mormon, and he let me have it about all these things, and we talked about some things, and then after that, he came back and asked me, well, what do you think about the Book of Mormon? So with a big grin on my face, I say, well, I believe it's true. And his jaw drops into his salad, and you know, then he starts right into attacking Joseph Smith again, and you know, so we carried on from there. But in the end of that conversation, he settled down, and we were able to have a good conversation there, a discussion. You know, he basically made the statement something like that, you know, if he hadn't known me and known the kind of person that I was, he would have probably just rejected me if he'd known that up front. But because he knew me, he knew that I, you know, he basically said, you know, I may not agree with you on everything here, but you know, I can still say, you know, you're my brother in Christ. And I said, I appreciated that, and you know, I was glad that that was the case. And my wife had a similar experience with a friend of hers in college, where she finally, after a period of time, shared with her about the Book of Mormon, and her friend basically said, you know, if you told me this up front, I wouldn't have paid any attention to you, but I know the kind of person you are. And so she at least was willing to, you know, not cast off the idea that, you know, that she was a Christian and good person, even though she believed in this Book of Mormon. And so sometimes our witness needs to start with who we are rather than immediately jumping into all of our distinctive beliefs and, you know, beating them over the head with the Book of Mormon, perhaps. You know, this is where we have to discern what the people are ready for. And so, you know, I made the point, of course, this was to a group of youth, but if you don't have your own testimony of Jesus Christ and the gospel, it doesn't matter how much you know, because you can't defend something that you don't ultimately believe in. And, you know, I think that certainly applies to all of us, that, you know, we need to have that testimony of Jesus Christ before we can really defend the gospel with conviction. Using the story of the sons of Mosiah as kind of an example of preparation and presentation of conversational apologetics and of witnessing. In the first case, they had their own testimony. They obviously had their own testimony. They had the witness of the angel that came and shook them up and presented, you know, to them the truth of Jesus Christ. And I said, you know, if you heard it before, but if you don't have a testimony, get one. And obviously, you brethren I know do, but it's always something that we can go more. The Lord is gracious in the fact that He is very deep, and there's always more for us to have. There's always a deeper testimony and a deeper knowledge that He has set before us. So even if we've had a testimony 20 years ago, we need to keep seeking for that fresh experience. And in Alma 12:17, of course, it says the sons of Mosiah that the Lord did visit them and said unto them, be comforted. And they were comforted. And this was their testimony before they went out and into the hands of the Lamanites, that this was the Lord's will that they do this. Also in terms of preparation is their prayer and fasting. They had given themselves to much prayer and fasting. Therefore, they had the spirit of prophecy and the spirit of revelation. And they'd fasted much and prayed much that the Lord would go with them and that a portion of their spirit to go with them and abide with them. And of course, that was answered. And so having God's spirit with us is the only way that we can succeed in this effort. Anything less than that, we're going to fail, no matter how much knowledge we have up in our heads, if we don't have that spirit of the Lord with us. I said, prayer is like clothes. Don't go running around without it. If we try to charge out into the battle without having that that cloak of prayer, we're certainly not going to succeed. Before we start each day, pray for charity, pray for opportunities to share. I've been challenging over the last several months challenging the branch to pray that the Lord would bring people to us who are seeking the gospel. That, you know, not just that maybe saying in some vague way that we might be able to reach out, but that maybe the Lord would actually bring people to our doors that are asking and seeking, and that we would then be able to minister to those, you know, so praying for opportunities. When we're having conversations, you know, praying silently that the Lord would guide our words, obviously, and we need that wisdom and discernment for what to say. And then as the hymn says, prayer can change the night today. Yeah, I'm going quickly through this because a lot of this you obviously know about, but hopefully there will be some thoughts. And anytime you want to bring something up, please feel free to get my attention here. Third study, and Book of Mormon says that they were men of sound understanding, and they had searched the scriptures diligently that they might know the word of God. And then also that he told them to go forth and establish my word. Not their opinions about his word, or not their ideas or speculations, but his word. And then Timothy, 2 Timothy 2:15, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman not that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And I think I've pointed out in other classes before, but that word study doesn't just mean what we think of opening the books and study, but it's a whole lifestyle of energy and effort put into to the acquisition of this knowledge. There we go. I've forgotten my next slide. The study there means to diligent, prompt, earnest effort, not just the reading of books. So the Greek word doesn't just mean what we think of study is the mental exercise, but it's a complete diligence and effort to read and study the scriptures, to know what we believe and why do we believe it. But then beyond the scriptures, to study all good books, because many times we can use those as either illustrations or understandings or deepen our knowledge of God's word through other sources of truth. To look for truth and look for God in everything we do and in all of our studies, including our secular activities. And this is something that I found is, you know, I've always made this my focus, I guess, you know, high school and on into college, that, you know, whatever I was studying in class, and I could tell you some stories from my calculus class of finding God in calculus. Of course, it's the study of infinity, so you might expect that you would find God there, but I won't go into those examples right now, but my social psychology class was just, Proverbs and the scriptures were just popping off the page, every chapter that we studied, just, well, this is what God said, 3,000 years ago, that they're finding that and discovering it through scholarly research and study in psychology. And various things. To seek truth and be prepared to share it with others, and then to be able to clearly explain our beliefs. Because sometimes we know what we believe, but are we able to actually explain what's the basis for it, and how do we distinguish this belief from what other people believe, and that kind of thing. It sometimes takes some preparation to be able to actually elaborate and to elucidate those thoughts to someone, to make it make sense to someone, even though it's made sense to us because we grew up with it. Four, to live a godly example. And again, in the Sons of Mosiah, it says that they were to be patient in long-suffering and afflictions, that ye may show forth good examples unto them in me. And I will make you an instrument, I will make an instrument of thee in my hands unto the salvation of many souls. And then along with that, I said, be committed to people. In Alma 12:34, Ammon, I believe, said, I desire to dwell among this people for a time, perhaps until the day I die. And I gave that just as an example of the general principle that we need to be more concerned about people than just about doctrines and items of truth, but to be concerned for the hearts and souls of individuals. And I know for myself, sometimes I can be very academic and study for the sake of study sometimes, or for acquisition of knowledge, but that needs to be our compelling interest, is the hearts and souls of mankind. To be concerned for their needs. And in Alma 12:43, it says, his heart was swollen within him with joy. And then later it says, I may win the hearts of these my fellow servants, that I may lead them to believe in my words, and that to have a servant attitude. He says, I am a man and thy servant. Whatsoever thou desirest which is right, that will I do. And so having a servant attitude toward the people that we're speaking to and ministering among. And next, to be diligent and faithful in all of our work. And the king, he says, was more astonished because of the faithfulness of Ammon. He doth remember all the commandments, all of my commandments, to execute them. And so that is part of our witness and part of our example before we can ever engage in a discussion, that we need to have that conversation, that behavior, that will bear witness of the truth that resides within us. And to gain the trust of those around us. in Alma 12:43, that I may win the hearts of these my fellow servants. I read that one earlier. He wanted to gain their trust before he could actually share with them the gospel. So that's just what the thoughts that I had on preparation for this conversation or this discussion. And next on presentation, I said how we present ourselves in conversation or in discussion with others makes a huge difference on their perception. Oops, I think I went past it. Okay, on their perception of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so there are several points here under this heading. One, I said attitude is everything. That we need to always be, no matter what, polite and courteous and respectful. And if you've dealt with people that are hostile toward our faith, you know, that's not always easy to do. It's easy to, you know, engage in argumentation in response to their, hostile argumentation. And, you know, one thought, I don't recall if I've put it in here later, but, you know, in those kind of situations, pray for our enemies. You know, suffer those, you know, that would persecute us. And to bear those things, you know, but to have that humble attitude and that politeness and courteousness, no matter what comes at us, make a big difference. Whether it's to the person that we're talking to, maybe they won't ever change, but maybe the people around us, witnessing this dialogue, will say, hey, there's something different about that person. And so that's just part of our attitude that comes across. And again, be genuinely concerned about the other person and their needs. And there's several things we could say there. You know, sometimes the people argue against certain points of our belief, not necessarily on an academic level or a doctrinal level, but maybe because they're deeply troubled about something. You know, if you've read The Call of the Evening years ago and some of the discussion about life after death, people's reaction against Christianity in that book was presented was not necessarily because they doctrinally disagreed with Christians on their beliefs, but because, you know, my mother was, you know, died this, or, you know, the feelings and the experiences that they've had in life may have soured them on the idea that there is a God. And we'll talk about some of those things in the third section of this. But there are feelings involved, not necessarily just mental and doctrinal beliefs on the part of other people, why they may be difficult difficult for them to accept our doctrines or our beliefs. And so we need to be concerned about those needs and those feelings that they have that are behind their beliefs. I said it's appropriate to use humor sometimes, at least if it's appropriately done, to open the door for discussion, to relate to the other person on a personal level, or to lighten the mood of a tense conversation. Sometimes we get so buried in the argument and in the dialogue there that we, you know, let things get a little too tense, and sometimes we can just kind of step back and use a little humor to, you know, lighten things up and to be personable. And that's just all a part of the, as I was saying, attitude is everything. And the next point that I said in presentation is that we need to remember that that our job and God's job is not, it's not our responsibility for changing someone else's heart and changing someone else's mind. That's God's job. We can't change somebody else's heart and change their mind. And I think so often, you know, I can get into the mode of, if I can just present the argument strongly enough and forcefully enough and, you know, completely enough, they'll have to change their mind and believe like I do. We can't do that. You know, God's got to do that. Our responsibility is simply to share the truth and share our testimony, and to let him do the rest. And that's the best that we can do. And that's what we're called to do, is to bear our testimony and leave it up to the Lord and leave it up to them to make their choice and make their decision. And again, the scripture is that we may be an instrument in the hands of God to bring, if it were possible, our brethren. They're just an instrument. They can't, you know, they can't force them, but they can only present. And there are a couple of guiding lights that I have guided me in the way that I've come to approach the subject over the years from Joseph Smith, and a couple of quotes that I'll have on the next few slides. This is a quote from Joseph Smith. He says, "If I esteem mankind to be in error, shall I bear down on them? No, I will lift them up, and in their own way too. If I cannot persuade them my way is better, I will not seek to compel any man to believe as I do. Only by force of reasoning, It wasn't force or reasoning, just as a correction there, just to make sure you're clear on that. But only by force of reasoning, he says, for truth will cut its own way. What's that?
You're kind of using that to tell the gospel to somebody who maybe hasn't heard it. Mm-hmm. Is that a good way to deal with our brothers and sisters? Each of us, you know, we have different opinions about different things. And is that a good way to...
Absolutely. To answer your question, absolutely. You know, we're talking about maybe people outside of our faith, but all of this applies even to our discussion and conversation with our brothers within the faith. By experience at least, is our online conversations that we somehow there's something about the impersonality of it that we tend to beat each other up more when we're separated, but maybe sometimes we do that same thing in person too. And you know, I think this would certainly apply to any of our differences of opinion with anybody that we meet. Not to bear down on them, not to force or to, you know, to beat each other up verbally, you know, if they don't see the way we do, but to just speak the truth, and as Joseph says, let truth cut its own way. And Kent?
Well, it also talks about the sower. The idea is that you sow the seeds.
Yeah, sowing the seeds.
I like the idea of the force of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
If you reason through things, you can't, you said it, you can't force anybody, but when we throw out reasoning that cannot be denied, and they deny it, that doesn't mean it goes away. It still sits there and simmers and stews and, you know, whatever it has to do inside the person, and eventually, if they are led by the Lord, they will, that nugget will produce.
Right. We want to plant the seed and then see it, the next day, the magic bean pop up with a beanstalk, you know, the next day, and it just doesn't work that way. And it's a well-known fact out in Christianity that, you know, something like 10 to 15 times that you have to share your faith with somebody on average before they come to believe. And, you know, point has been made in different songs and presentations that, you know, you might be the number one, you might be the number 15. And you never know who you're talking with. And so you just sow the seed or water it and let the Lord bring forth the increase. So.
I would also like to add that I don't think that is, he said this and it's absolutely true,
mm-hmm.
but it isn't applicable in every aspect
mm-hmm.
of everything we do. Sometimes there is something you can never compel them, but sometimes you have to be a little more than just force of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of J.J. Cornish, when he was debating that minister.
Mm-hmm.
The guy kept talking to him about hell, and he said, you'll find hell soon enough if you don't. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, and I'll get to that too. There's some boldness that times we need to use. Yeah, and I agree with that. I think the general point at least is still a lot of validity here. So, and there's another that may have come from the same quotation, but I didn't include it. I don't remember. It seems like Joseph also said something about the fact that if I can't convert a man to, you know, to my religion, at least if I can make him a better Baptist or a better Methodist, you know, by my sharing with him. You know, I'm happy about that. You know, he was happy about that sort of thing. So, again, you know, maybe you can't bring them all the way, but at least if something that we share with them can make them better or come closer to the truth, the Lord's, you know, praised for that. Did you have a... I don't know. Okay. the next example that I have here is one that you're probably all familiar with, and... this comes from the instance in Times and Seasons where Joseph Smith was, this Methodist minister came to Nauvoo and came to and hear Joseph Smith preach. And this is, I believe, in 1842. And then, you know, he came with these preconceived ideas of what he'd heard, all these terrible demon things about, you know, about the church and Joseph Smith. And when he heard Joseph preach that morning, he was just totally astounded at how Joseph presented in just a very compelling and very orderly way, not this fiery, you know, crazy man kind of thing. And in the evening, he was invited to take the pulpit. And I've suggested to our brothers sometimes, you know, we're unwilling to have some of our own brothers take the pulpit sometimes, but here they had a Methodist minister come and preach to the people, preach to the saints. And he went away testifying, and this was printed in the Times and Seasons, just a portion of this. He said, the congregation was large and respectable. They paid the utmost attention. This surprised me a little, as I did not expect to find any such thing as a religious toleration among them. After I had closed, Elder Joseph Smith, who had attended, arose and begged leave to differ with me in a few points of doctrine. And this he did mildly, politely, and affectingly, like one who was more desirous to disseminate truth and expose error than to love the malicious triumph of debate over me. I was truly edified with his remarks and felt less prejudiced against the Mormons than ever. And this is one of those guiding lights that I've taken in my life, you know, over the years, because I know that at times I have loved the, you know, malicious triumph of debate, you know, to love the, you know, make the forceful point and prove myself right and that kind of thing. And I still do that sometimes, I'm sure, but I've tried to, you know, temper that enthusiasm with, you know, respectfulness and just, you know, presenting the truth instead of trying to triumph over the person and stomp down their arguments and, you know, destroy their falsehoods and, you know, but to hopefully build them up in whatever way possible. The third point under presentation is speak the truth. We don't have to answer every question, every criticism, and every objection, but just stick to what we know and admit it when we don't know the answer, rather than trying to come up with some, you know, manufacturing some statement out of the blue that may or may not be true. We can just say, I don't know, but I'll go find out. And, you know, if they're willing to, you know, talk with us again, we may come back with the answer later. As far as truth goes, again, a quote from Joseph Smith, he says, one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may. And this means if the Baptist is speaking truth, I agree with that. If a Latter-day Saint is speaking untruth, I'm going to reject it. It doesn't matter where the truth comes from. If it's truth, we can accept it. But if it's partly true and partly false, we can still accept it. Just recognize the parts that are true and the parts that we need to cast off. And I said, remember, truth is more than just facts that can be studied. And section 90, verse 4b says, I don't have the book in front of me, but it says a lot of things about truth. Truth is independent in the spheres which is created. Truth is the knowledge of things as they are and as they were and as they are to come. So it's more than just book learning, but it's all truth.
That second point of there, one of the grand fundamental principles, that would be something that we could all learn from today. Too many times that we set aside because of who the messenger is, not because of the messenger.
That's a good point. Not just what they're saying, but because of the messenger is coming from heavens, the community of Christ, or, you know, the Baptist Church or somewhere. Oh, well, they, you know, we tend to cast off sometimes what they say just because it's coming from someone that we don't trust. We think they have an ulterior motive or something else. There's nothing wrong with saying, that's true, I agree with that, but I disagree with you on this. You know, there's an area of that what you said that I don't agree with, and here's why I disagree with you. You know, just doing it in a respectful way. Under the fourth point, I said avoid argumentation. Don't try to win arguments, but simply declare the truth and to declare our testimony. And this is one I like. It says, that's a good point. You know, somebody says something that's true, that's a good point. You know, even if I disagree with what their main conclusion or, you know, something else that they said, we can still affirm the agreement first and kind of deflect some of the hostility there by seeking agreement, seeking truth. The scripture that I remember comes to mind is, it says, agree with thine adversary quickly, lest he cast thee into prison and you have to stay there till you pay the other most. Well, I'm not worried about going to prison for these discussions necessarily, but, you know, the first part of that has some applicability is, agree with thine adversary quickly. If there's something to be agreed with, there's something that's worthy of, you know, agreement there, we can agree. We can show our common brotherhood there by, you know, agreeing, and then respectfully disagreeing with other things, and it's more of a respectful conversation then. Another one that I like is, instead of saying, you're wrong, say, here's how I see it. And a less threatening way of explaining the rationality of what we believe and you know, as I see it or as I understand it, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, you know, if I'm wrong, show me. And I, of course, Henry Schaeffer, you remember, you know, he would always say, you know, if you can show me that I'm wrong, I want to know, and so please, you know, correct me. It's just a very self-deflating, you might say, or a self-deprecating kind of way to come to the conversation in humility, rather than I'm on top of the truth here and I'm going to show you how you're all wrong, you know, say, well, maybe I need to learn something too. Can you show me something that I'm, you know, that I need to expand my understanding in? But if not, how about considering this point of view? And so that kind of an attitude. And suggest alternative viewpoints. Maybe there's another way of looking at this. And so, again, suggesting that maybe there's a better way of looking at it, but again, these are just a different kind of ideas of approach, I guess, to avoid argumentation. Understand that other people's traditions, and even our own traditions at times, contain some truth mixed with error. And so we all see through the glass darkly. And so, not to get too haughty about everything that I believe must be true because I was taught it in Sunday school class in the real nice Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, therefore it must be right. Well, okay, but let's see. Can it stand up to reason? Is it true? And then, again, I think there's a quote from Joseph on this, but I don't recall where it comes from. Don't destroy someone else's foundation, but rather to seek to build it up. One sort of side example of this is in the Book of Mormon. It talks about that the restoration didn't come forth to destroy that which they already had. It didn't come to destroy the truth of the Bible, but to affirm it and to build it up. Yeah, there's a couple of verses in the Book of Mormon. I don't recall the verses now. Go ahead.
We're admonished not to allow our brothers to stumble, or not to cause our brothers to stumble.
Mm-hmm. Not to cause others to stumble. And I guess maybe one way of looking at this would be, don't just say, oh, you're wrong about this, and you're wrong about this, and your church is wrong about this, but then not being able to give them something better to move on to. If we destroy their faith, but then not give them something better to move on to, then we haven't done them any favors. So,
there's okay. Another area, I think, in the Book of Mormon where it shines. King Lamoni was having a conversation with Ammon, and he called God Great Spirit. Well, Ammon didn't toss that out and challenge him.
Oh, no, not your pagan Great Spirit. No, no.
It was into the idea, and before long, King Lamoni was calling the Great Spirit God.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that, as a teacher, that's an exceptionally good way to teach, and I was really impressed that I found that in the Book of Mormon. I thought, mm-hmm. You know, this book is deeper than we even imagine in so many mm-hmm. different ways.
Mm-hmm.
It really truly is true.
Yeah, to take what they have and to build on it. And, you know, and of course it's maybe a fine line. You could take the same thing out to the Native Americans today. You know, they worship the Great Spirit maybe, or they have certain ideas. Well, some of those are mixed with tradition, obviously, just like it was with the Lamanites. Can we build on those things rather than saying, oh, you're all like the Christians came in and said, oh, you're all paganism, let's just destroy all your books and destroy your things and replace it with Catholicism or replace their traditions. They should have been building them up and taking that and building them to higher ground instead of totally destroying their foundation.
I was going to say, what he's talking about, Ammon talking to the King Lamoni and the Spirit, that, as you read that, that adds to the truth itself of the Book of Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
The truth's in there all along, that just, you can't argue with it.
Yeah, very deep truths in the Book of Mormon. That's certainly one of them. Where am I? Let's see. Okay, build on the truths they already accept. Oh, yeah, probably, I hadn't gotten this up there yet, but it's probably the example you gave, in fact, from Alma, I'm pretty sure. Okay, again, ask questions. This is an excellent thing, too. Ask questions to understand another's beliefs or positions, rather than assuming when they say something that we understand what all they believe and we can just knock it down and replace it with something else. Make sure we understand why they're saying what they do and why they believe what they do. And to clarify terms, which goes along with that. Well, what do you mean by salvation? Or what do you mean by, you know, hell or heaven or, you know, whatever it might be, to understand before we try to argue. Okay, and above all, bear an affirmative testimony. Seek for ways to turn the conversation into a positive affirmation of the gospel, and to turn it away from the negative sides and the negative argumentation sides of things. Show how the gospel principles, rightly understood, are the most reasonable and meaningful answers to life's questions. And don't be discouraged. It's if God be for us, who can prevail against us? Don't allow the criticism from others to cause us to doubt our own faith or our own conversion. As the scripture says, the Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. But going back to a previous point, we can't answer all of their objections, still rely on that testimony of the Holy Spirit that has testified to us of the truth and that will lead us into all truth, that maybe we will have those answers, but we've got to rely on that Spirit and that testimony. Again, the faith is the assurance of things hoped for. And then a quote from Chuck Colson, the gift of faith is most real when we trust, even when every outward reality tells us there is no reason to do so. And I don't take that as maybe an absolute statement, because at some point the evidence does need to bear up what we believe, but there are times when maybe we lose sight or we lose faith. We need to rely on that faith and rely on that Spirit of the Lord. And my testimony of that from college was, you know, I went in as a high school student. I was, you know, grew up in the 1984 period and studied and understood my beliefs and went to the Baptist University with, like, there's 3,000 Baptists and one Latter-day Saint, and go in there, and it wasn't quite as easy as what I thought. Not only that, it was, you know, everything that I believed got challenged, down to the point where I said, I'm not so sure about this, I'm not so sure about Joseph Smith and all this, but I know for absolute fact that the basic principles of the gospel, you know, repentance for baptism for remission of sins, that is so absolutely fundamentally true and sustainable in the Bible that there's no way they can shake my faith on this. Well, what was the next thing they tried to shake my faith on? Baptism for remission of sins. And I won't go into all that testimony right now because I don't have time, but came away from a conversation where a guy went through the whole Bible with all these different scriptures that I used as well, and basically tried to prove, and seemed to actually prove, that baptism wasn't necessary for salvation. How can you do that? How can that work? I know these scriptures. Anyway, the testimony came from that the Lord showed me the answer, and then circled around, and I was able to bear testimony to him, and in fact later on found that he changed his belief. But for a period of time, I had to go on faith, because every foundation that I had was getting knocked out from underneath me, and you know, I had to keep relying on that Spirit and that testimony that I'd had. And so sometimes that can happen. Don't allow a barrage of doubtful disputations on specific questions to cloud our vision or the grand picture of our faith. And this, if you've argued with XRLDS or anything, people, very hostile people, you can just get one argument after the other, after the other, after the other, and they never wait for the answers. They all just keep, like, a machine gun approach. It's an effective way, you know. If you throw, you know, spray somebody with a machine gun, you might not hit them with the 100 bullets, but it only takes one, right? And so if we allow those kind of things to come at us and destroy our faith, you know, we need to recognize that when it's happening. There's a quote, it's up there, okay. It says, the evidence for evaluating a religious worldview comes from many sources of knowledge: science, history, personal experience, social awareness, and spiritual revelation. The combination of evidences, along with the unified worldview they create, is sufficiently compelling to make a life commitment. And again, I give this in kind of in the context of, you know, we might not be able to answer all the questions, but when we step back and we have this grand view of what the restoration is all about, when Christianity's, but the restoration specifically, even though if we can't answer all these little nagging questions and doubts and things like that, the whole overall view of the presentation of truth in the Book of Mormon and in the Latter-day Gospel is sufficiently compelling. It has evidence and support from many different areas of life. You know, even if we can't answer everything, we can see that this is a valid worldview to hold, and this is holds better answers overall than other worldviews and other points of view out there. And so the questions that we can't answer, sometimes we just have to let those go and look at the big picture, I guess is the point there. Then sometimes the best defense is a good offense. As Ken mentioned, the J.J. Cornish, you know, speaking very boldly to a minister that he was talking with in debate. We don't always have to, and I find this, I do this sometimes, have done this in the past, is that we don't always have to be on the defensive and always reacting to the criticisms and always answering and having to, oh, how do I answer this one and how do I answer this one, but to sometimes go on the defensive and ask them hard questions. Jesus did that. You know, he would ask them, well, what do you think about, you know, this question, or Paul, when he asked him, well, what do you think about the resurrection of the dead? And so the Sadducees and the Pharisees all start arguing with each other, and they walk away and leave him alone because they couldn't argue with, they couldn't agree with each other. You know, so finding ways to kind of, you know, throw it back on them, for instance. And Alma 18:14 says, use boldness. But the trick is not overbearance. We can use boldness, all right, but sometimes we get to be a little too bold and a little too overbearing and bearing down on them, like Joseph said, and we need to be careful of that. And then in meekness, challenge the other person's assumptions, facts, and conclusions. And one example that I read on this, when Chuck Colson, when he was having a TV debate with Madeline Murray O'Hare, the famous atheist, you know, she basically makes a statement that, you know, the Bible is a brutal, horrible book. And so he hands her a Bible and says, show me where, you know, where these passages are. And she's backing away like it's a weapon, you know, and she won't touch it. And she says, all she could say is, oh, it's just full of hate and murder. But she couldn't sustain her position. And so sometimes, you know, throwing it back on them and making them answer some hard questions is appropriate, certainly. And let's see, next. Okay, and this is a couple of examples from Jesus and from Paul of asking the others to make, you know, some leading questions and some challenging ideas. And then one thing that we sometimes fail to do is we present our beliefs, but then we never ask them to make a commitment. You know, will you at least consider this? You know, would you consider this church or, consider being baptized? You know, ask them for a commitment. I've heard some presentations even from out, you know, from Christian speakers, you know, we teach them all about Jesus, but we never actually ask them to come to Jesus. And so we need to, you know, think of that as far as asking them to actually do something about what we've just told them, you know, whether they'll accept it or not. And then this again, an example from Ammon. Ammon, being wise yet harmless, he said unto Lamoni, wilt thou hearken unto my words? So he's asking him, what are you going to do about this now that I've told you this? Are you going to accept it or not? So forcing him to make a decision, either yes or no. Not forcing him, but basically putting him in a position where he would have to make a choice, not just hear a bunch of facts and then walk away without any commitment on his part. Okay, so the next, I've got a section on specific subjects that come up. And again, you know, we could take all day answering lots of questions and lots of different things. We could take days and days probably answering every question that we might face. What I tried to do is throw in some different ideas that common questions from both secular and from evangelical points of view. And of course, I was giving this to the youth, and I asked them, you know, what questions have you been faced with that you've had a hard time answering? And I could throw that out here, or maybe we could wait till later if there's something I don't touch on. But, you know, is there some question, maybe I'll throw it out for a minute, some really burning question or hard question that you've come across that it's really a hard, you have a hard time answering? I've certainly had lots of those. Some that I still don't know if I can answer. What's that, Steve?
Well, I've argued with some atheists, and they're smarter than Madeline O'Hara, because they say, well, I'll give you an example. So he said, well, when God killed all those people that Israel was wandering in the wilderness and they disobeyed and so forth, wiped them all out with earthquakes and plagues.
Right.
So what's your answer to an atheist who says all these deadly things happen in the Bible?
Right, yeah, God commanded them to go out and wipe out the Canaanites and, you know, destroyed all these people, yeah. So, you know, I'm not going to try to answer that one right now, but I think there are some things that I'll get to in a kind of a different subject, but I think it'll be related as far as God's justice and things that are, when I get to the section on would God condemn people to hell, I think there's a similar, probably a lot of similar answers in that section that would talk about, you know, why does God condemn people now, or bring judgment now, I guess. So maybe that might be something there. But let me go ahead and jump into it. One of the first that I decided to tackle here was the subject of God as creator versus evolution. So the atheist says evolution has been proved beyond reasonable doubt by scientific investigation. Belief in a divine creator is unnecessary and unreasonable. So how do we answer that? There's several different things. There's several different slides here, but I thought one. Let's suppose for a moment that there is a God. Okay, just suppose for a moment. Would that be okay with you? Would you have a problem with a God if one really exists? You know, find out what is the real objection to someone believing in God, first of all. Because the question may expose what their real problem is with God. The problem really isn't that evolution disproves God. The problem may be that they have something in their life that has caused them to be offended at the very idea of God. That's where we really need to focus, rather than getting tied up in an evolution debate and all the hours that might go into that. If their real problem is that something happened years ago, they were abused as a child, and how can God let that happen? Well, that's where you really need to focus. That's their real objection to God, not all the science necessarily. That's just an excuse. If there is a God, do you think it could ever be proved? If not, why? If you don't think that God could ever be proved, then how can you say, first of all, that there isn't one? And if you do think God could be proved, what would it take for God to be proven to you? So this isn't just a theoretical idea now. What would it take for you to come to what proof would it take for you to believe or to consider that there might really be a God? And so if they can tell you that, then that's where you can maybe focus. Well, let's talk about that. What evidence would be most convincing to the existence of a living, real, divine being? For instance, would a first-hand witness of God be stronger than evidence from archaeology or philosophical reasoning? In other words, if somebody had seen God himself, would that be more convincing to you than if I can prove God from archaeology or something? I can prove God from reason. And if first-hand evidence, if they say, oh yeah, if somebody had actually seen God, well, that would be the something. Well, then here we go. People have seen God. Ken?
I have a problem with the artifact thing and wherever we go. There's all sorts of literature out there. And who's to say in 100 years from now somebody might pick up a book that is absolutely condemning of something and they think that is the world view, when in reality it's just a specific view. Or it's specific to that individual, and because they don't have other books to support it, they take that, and that makes their argument expand to the entire society at the time. So I struggle with some of that, but I think it has to be there has to be some accountability in the archaeology or the artifacts that are left in with other things that can be found.
Right. So archaeology can kind of pick piecemeal little bits and pieces here, but they don't necessarily put together the whole picture of what was really going on at a certain point in time.
Exactly. And they just found, I don't know if you've read that, but they found a baby woolly mammoth in the Russian Arctic Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was completely, he still got his skin on, he was frozen.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty awesome. If they're frozen like that and no deterioration, what's it tell us?
So go ahead.
I personally am not opposed to God using some evolutionary principles to bring about the universe the way it has been brought out. There's a lot of evidence that goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And you get into these theories of the Big Bang and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My answer to that is there has to be a first cause.
Yep.
But then there's the continued cause of God in our lives to bring about his kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about some of those different viewpoints among Christians, because there are lots of different viewpoints among Christians on this subject of evolution and God's involvement, or in some cases non-involvement in certain aspects. Not non-involvement, but not direct involvement, let's say, but letting the natural forces work out themselves according to natural laws and things, but yeah.
Some of our greatest scientists were strong believers in God. Mm-hmm. That was Albert Einstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Einstein was sort of a believer in a deity. He wasn't necessarily a believer in God or a Christian God, but he did have some kind of...
He was a Jew.
Yeah.
God,
yeah. But certainly Isaac Newton and many of the others, Galileo and Copernicus and others, were strong believers. Let's see, where did we go? Okay, and so then, you know, if the first-hand witness is going to be meaningful to you, if somebody would actually see God, well... Okay, would you be willing to consider their testimony? And if not, if somebody had seen God, I wouldn't be willing to believe their testimony. Well, why not? You know, isn't first-hand witness the more reason to